compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
And a happy Monday morning. Welcome back, Cyrus. I guess you should be saying welcome back to me, right?
Welcome back. It's good to have you back.
Thank you. Yeah, just a little R&R, that's all. I was pleased to see, though, that people noticed my absence. And Father Matthew, what a great job he did in my absence filling in for me. Also, Jim Burnham, thank you very much for the great job that you did. And Cyrus, thank you and the crew for holding everything together. You know how it is. Every so often, you just need a little time off. And I'm tanned, rested, and ready.
Well, don't let it happen again.
Okay. Until the next time.
Anyway. Until the next time, yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you again, Cyrus. And my thanks to everybody. Hey, my number is 888-914-9149. I want to tell you about a guy you've never heard about, but somebody who saved a lot of lives. And I'm surprised I had never heard of him before. But then as I started reading his story, I can see why he just kind of faded into obscurity. His name was Vincent Coleman. Does that name ring any bells, Cyrus? Vincent Coleman?
No.
You weren't around in 1917, I don't think, were you?
No, I missed that year.
No. Yeah, you missed it. Well, here's the story. This is an amazing story. He was a dispatcher in Halifax, Nova Scotia. And this is on December the 6th, 1917. Now, Canadian citizens, they will know that date from their history studies in school. That's the date that there was this massive harbor explosion in Halifax. It practically wiped out the city. Everything near where the water was when the ship blew up, it just completely flattened everything for miles around. So he was a dispatcher. And he was one of the guys who would help with traffic of the ships coming and going. His granddaughter, Anna Finlayson, she said in an interview from her home in Ottawa, she said, he was an ordinary man, a family man. He just went to work that day, never assuming anything special was going to happen. She remembers growing up hearing the story of Coleman, who was working as a train dispatcher in the station in the Richmond Depot just before two ships collided in Halifax Harbor. So he would coordinate with the ships. And, okay, here comes the train. You can load, offload your stuff on the trains, and the trains are going to load stuff on the ships. So he was in that capacity. He realized that the ship, the Mont Blanc, was going to blow up. It was a munition ship, a military ship. So he was sending frantic messages trying to stop a train full of passengers who were headed for the city. Moments later came word that his message was received, but by then it was too late for him to flee the blast. So here's what happened. He realized, Cyrus, that he could have escaped what was going to happen. He could see that this munition ship was on fire. It had collided with another ship, and it was going to blow up, and there wasn't much time. And he was in the little, you know, the telegraph operator booth. And he was sending messages to the train saying, stop, don't come any closer. And he realized he had to make a choice. He had to choose between his own life, because if he stayed long enough to send a message that would get to them in time, he himself would die because he was too close to where the explosion took place. And that's exactly what happened. His granddaughter said they heard this tremendous bang and they saw clouds coming up from the harbor. And the teacher said, I think, children, we are being attacked. Run home. So they all ran home. She said her mother was described as the street was on fire. Houses were burning. People were running up Russell Street Hill. They were all running away from the water, screaming and yelling. Finlayson's grandmother, Frances, and her aunt Eileen, who was a baby at the time, they had serious injuries. And in their case, it took months to heal. Their house collapsed. Finlayson's mother and siblings were sent to live with their grandmother in a different part of town. The family finally reunited a year and a half after the explosion. Frances Coleman was now a widow with four children to raise, left with just a few mementos of her husband. She said, my grandfather's telegrapher's key and his watch were the only two things that were given to her when they found his body. They were kept in a treasured, safe place by the grandmother. Here was his final message. Munition ship on fire, making for Pier 6, goodbye. So he realized he wasn't going to make it, but he waited and waited until he got word that that train finally got the message, and all the people on that train survived as a result of his generosity. Is that not an amazing story?
That is cool. I'm looking at some of these old pictures that are on that article. Very interesting stuff. I'll put that up on the show Twitter,
please do.
Twitter page so people can check that out.
Yeah, quite a story. And Nancy and I had an opportunity to visit Halifax a couple of years ago. And it's a lovely city. And I had no clue that this even took place. It was just one of those historical events that if you never studied it, you wouldn't know what happened. And so standing there on the embankment, the promenade, overlooking where this waterway is, you can see how, because the ship was loaded with so much ammunition, that when it blew up, it just destroyed everything for miles in every direction. And it's just amazing that this man had the courage to stick it out, and knowing that his own life would be lost in the end. It reminds me of what Jesus said about greater love has no man than to lay down his life for his friends. And that's exactly what he did. 888-914-9149 is the number to call. We have a backlog of people waiting to get on the air. So let's do that first. Let's start off with Mark listening in Boston. Hi, Mark. Welcome.
Hi, Patrick. Welcome back.
Thank you.
I'm a longtime listener, a first-time caller, and I have a question for you about my mother.
Okay.
She's had health issues for a long time, including dementia. And I've been a full-time caregiver for years, and I consider myself fortunate, and I'm happy to help. It can be difficult at times. Mm-hmm. And she aspirated this past Tuesday. She's currently on life support at the hospital. And when she arrived...
Did she aspirate food or water, or what happened exactly?
She was in bed. It was just the contents of her stomach.
Okay, I see.
It had been a while since she'd eaten, but it was enough to cause a serious problem.
Okay.
And when she arrived at the hospital, there was an opportunity to save her and give her a chance. And I didn't want to lose her, so I took the chance. And right now her outlook isn't good. She's fighting. She has a pneumonia. But it's obvious to look at her that she's suffering. And in the near future, life support may need to be withdrawn. So I first and foremost wanted to ask your listeners to please pray for my mother. Her name's Margaret. And the question I have for you is, does her suffering have value, even though in her current mental state she can't offer it up herself or unite it to the suffering of Jesus? So I'm wondering if it has value and if it might reduce her time in purgatory.
Well, let's say yes, first of all, to both of those questions. Yes, her suffering does have value, and yes, any suffering that's offered to the Lord has a purifying effect, and that would shorten the time in purgatory if she needs to go to purgatory on her way to heaven. Here's something to remember, is that you can have what's called an actual intention, meaning in the here and now, at this moment, you're praying for a particular intention. But you can also have what the church regards as a virtual intention, which means that it may not be at the forefront of your mind. You may not be thinking about that particular person or this particular intention. And yet the church recognizes that God understands that you have, for your whole life, let's say, or for the last year, let's say, you have been praying in a particular way for a certain intention. Well, that intention remains virtual in your heart and in your mind. So I would rest easy in knowing that if your mom was a woman of prayer, well, I shouldn't say was, if she is a woman of prayer, and if her life, at least in some time frames of it, was marked by prayer and petition, well, those intentions that she would have of being close to the Lord and being forgiven of her sins would remain as virtual intentions, even if she weren't consciously thinking of it at that moment. Does that make sense?
It does, yes. And I'm happy to hear that. She spent her youth going to novena after novena, so she was a prayerful person. And I'm glad to hear that. And would you have any advice for me? I'm a faithful person myself, and I just feel so far from being ready to let her go.
Yeah.
I'd be willing to, you know, keep taking care of her for as long as was necessary. So I'm just wondering if you might be able to offer a word or two.
Well, that's generous of you, and she clearly raised a good son. So the easiest way to answer that question, I believe, is just to pray, Lord, thy will be done. What is your will, Lord? If your will is that my mom goes soon, then may it be a peaceful and easy passing. If it's your will that she remain longer, then I pray that whatever time you give her will be well spent, and that you'll help me to do whatever I can do to help her. Now, if you're able to be with her, Mark, I mean, like physically be in her presence would be ideal. I would get the Divine Mercy Chaplet and just pray that in her presence. We're told by St. Faustina that the Lord will give many great graces, especially at the time of death, even for somebody who's not praying the chaplet, but is in the presence of somebody who is. So I'm sure that will bring you and your mom both a lot of comfort.
I did that once a couple days ago. I switched over to the rosary, but I'm going to go back to the Divine Mercy Chaplet now upon hearing this. So thank you very much, Patrick.
You're welcome. And I would suggest both and. I would never want to pit the rosary against the Divine Mercy Chaplet or vice versa. But if you can do both, so much the better. Well, we'll pray for your mom in a special way, Mark. Thank you for that. And hang in there. I'm sure it's not easy. 888-914-9149. You can call me at that number right now. We have lines, just a couple open, but they are open. So call 888-914-9149. Why don't we go now to Mary in Stevens Point, Wisconsin. Hi, Mary.
Hi, thank you so much. I really appreciate all you do. I have a
Thanks.
Two-part question, which I'm going to state now so you know where I'm going. I'm trying to decide between the RSV Catholic Edition and the RSV Second Catholic Edition and the New American Bible for my use for scripture memorization. And secondly, I'm wondering if you think I don't need to re-memorize scripture that I've already memorized in a Protestant translation. Regarding the first part of the question, it works best for me to use an online Bible since my memorization system is on my computer. The RSV Catholic Edition and the New American Bible are both online, so I can copy and paste scripture verses mm-hmm. to memorize. But the RSV Second Catholic Edition isn't as easy to use on a computer. Do you think it's okay for me to go with the RSV Catholic Edition rather than a more updated translation? I was going to until I went to memorize 2 Corinthians 5:10, so I wanted to ask you if you think that 2 Corinthians 5:10 is an okay translation, even though it's so different in the RSV Catholic Edition than the New American Bible and from all other Protestant versions I see. In the RSV Catholic Edition, it says, "For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, so that each one may receive good or evil according to what he has done in the body." And in the New American Bible, it says, "For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, so that each one may receive recompense according to what he did in the body, whether good or evil." And do you think I need to rememorize when the verses that I've already memorized in a Protestant translation, even though I really meditate on and pray over verses I'm memorizing or reviewing, and even though the USCCB indicates that it may be that we may use any good Catholic Bible for private prayer and study, or that we should use a good, you know, Catholic one.
Got it. Okay. Well, I've never been asked that question before, and that's obviously very well thought out. It seems to me, Mary, that if you are going to re-memorize these passages using a Catholic edition, they won't be that different. I mean, they will be different enough, but they won't be that different. So in a way, it's almost like saying your prayers in a slightly different language. So whichever translation you find the easiest to commit to memory, I think would be fine. I don't think the church would say you're doing better or worse if you use one or the other translation. Now, the Revised Standard Version Catholic Edition, the first version of that seems entirely fine to me. The second edition has some inclusive language changes, and okay, I mean, that's not a problem insofar as it's going to be very close to the Revised Standard Version. The New American edition tends to be a little more clunky. I don't really like it as much, but what it has going for it is that it is the version that you hear read at Mass on Sunday and any other day of the week. So that's the version of the Bible that Catholics in the United States would be most familiar with. So you would have a familiar ring to it when you memorize from that edition. But it's not my favorite by far. So in a sense, it's kind of wide open. Whatever will help your memorization and your prayer, I think the church would say go for that.
Do you think that that's a good translation, the RSV of 2 Corinthians 5:10, where it says that we would actually receive good or evil according to what we've done in the body, even though other verses talk about recompensing, making it sound as according to whether you've done good or evil?
Mm-hmm. Well, let me read it. For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ so that each one may receive good or evil according to what he has done in the body. Now, there's nothing incorrect about this. It's not mistranslated. In fact, it tracks closely with what St. Paul says in Romans chapter 2. I'll read that to you, and I think you'll see the connection there. So he begins in verse 1 by talking about how nobody has an excuse and that we have a tendency to judge other people. But then he gets into the issue of rewarded. So he talks about how if people are repentant and they seek, as it says in verse 10, glory and honor and peace, they will receive glory, honor, and peace for everyone who does good, the Jew first and then the Greek. So this whole context here is related to the one that we just looked at in 2 Corinthians. So no, I don't see any problem with that translation. It would not have received the imprimatur by the Catholic Church had there been something truly faulty about it. So those are my thoughts, Mary. I hope that's helpful to you.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. 888-914-9149 is the number to call. We have a line that just opened up, 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Myra, listening in Lexington, Kentucky, horse country. Hi, Myra.
Hi, Patrick. Yes, in Keeneland time, too. You should come visit.
I'd love to, yes.
Yes. I have a teenager, and we've been trying to keep faith conversations going, and she recently asked me, how do we know Christianity is the correct religion with all the religions in the world? And if it is, what happens to all those that grow up sincerely believing in their faith? So I did a little research, tried to answer it the best I could, but just wanted to bounce that off you, get some wisdom, write down any resources you might have.
Sure. Well, why don't I start with the resource? I'll recommend a book by Peter Kraft. It's called Fundamentals of the Faith, and that is a compare and contrast between Christianity and these other world religions, Judaism, Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam, etc. So he considers each of these different world religions, gives kind of an explanation, what is the basic belief system here, and then he contrasts it, he compares it to, in other words, he shows where there are areas of similarity between Christianity and these other world religions, but the contrast is massive, and it centers on the person of Jesus Christ. And that's the key to the whole question that you're asking is how do we know that Christianity is true? Unlike, not that we're saying that these other world religions have no truth in them. We certainly don't say that. We recognize truth where we find it, and we can rejoice in that. But the fullness of the truth is only found in Christianity. So how can we know that? What is the means by which we can go beyond merely asserting it, but actually have a credible, rational basis upon which to believe this? Well, I would go back to the person of Jesus, and that this is what I would recommend that you do in conversation with your daughter. Just say, unlike any of the other founders of these different religions, unlike Muhammad or Moses or the Buddha, etc., none of these personages claimed to be God, but Jesus did. And his followers recognized that. In fact, those who didn't like Jesus or who were opposed to his message, they tried to kill him because it was part of the Mosaic law to stone to death anybody who would even lightly make use or misuse God's name. And Jesus went so far as to use the name of himself, that before Abraham was, I am, he said, and we're told that they picked up stones to kill him. And this happened on more than one occasion. So we can begin there and say that unlike any of these other religious leaders who had some ideas or they thought they were giving revelation, in some cases they were. So Moses, for example, truly was revealing things given to him by God. But unlike any of them, Jesus said, I am God himself. And he proved his divinity through his miracles, through his casting out of demons, through his reading of secret thoughts, his control over the weather, and most importantly, his own prophesied death on the cross and rising from the dead 3 days later. Now, I think maybe within the last couple of weeks I discussed this, but just a quick recap. The evidence can be found not only in the teachings of Jesus, but also in the fact that his followers claimed that he rose from the dead. So if he didn't really rise from the dead, as St. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15, then we're really the most pathetic of people. I would suggest you read that passage with your daughter. St. Paul says we're pitiful people if Jesus didn't really rise from the dead. Because if he didn't really rise from the dead, he's still dead. And if he's still dead, then we're dead in our sins and we have no hope. But the evidence is overwhelming that Jesus did rise from the dead. And among the evidence is the testimony of his followers who didn't merely say, yeah, he rose from the dead. They did so under pain of persecution and, for many of them, the promise of a very grisly, painful death. Rather than recant what they said that they saw, they said that they saw Jesus risen from the dead. In one passage, we're told in the New Testament that Jesus appeared at one time to 500 people. So they saw him and they spoke to him, many of them, and they ate with him in some cases. They touched him in some cases. So they knew that he wasn't a figment of their imagination. They knew that he had risen from the dead. And they knew him because they knew him before he had died on the cross. So it wasn't like, oh, there's this guy with a beard and he kind of looked like Jesus. No, it was Jesus. They knew it. So think about that and maybe talk to your daughter about that, that unlike any of these other religions, this religion, whose followers claim that it was founded by God himself and they were willing to die rather than recant something that if it weren't true, they would have known it wasn't true. They would have known that this was a scam. And you can imagine that it would be difficult to find somebody who would be willing to do that, knowing that it was really not true. But can you really expect to find hundreds or thousands of people who would be willing to do that? I think the likelihood of that taking place is so minuscule as to be impossible. And that's part of what Peter Crave talks about in that book. So maybe go down that road, and I think you'll find that very helpful. A second book, also by Peter Crave, is called Jesus Shock, and it takes up the same question. What do you make of the fact that Jesus rose from the dead? Thank you. I'll be right back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show right after this. This hour is sponsored by Ave Maria Mutual Funds, where financial goals are aligned with pro-life values and fund decisions are based on investment fundamentals designed to preserve and grow wealth without violating moral beliefs. More information at AveMariaFunds.com.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
Oh, that's sweet, Cyrus. That's nice.
Oh, you see what I'm doing there?
Oh, yeah. And all the people under, let's say, 50 years of age won't have a clue what this is all about. I do. Well, I used to watch this show on TV.
Welcome back, Patrick.
Ms. Jakarta. The actress who played his wife in this show, I think she was the wife on Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. I think she was the Rick Moranis' wife in that movie.
I wouldn't know.
That's a useless calorie of insignificant information. Well, thank you. Hey, I wanted to get to this story real quick before we go back to the phones. Speaking of phones, my number is 888-914-9149. I just cracked up when I saw this. Richard Dawkins. He's on Twitter, by the way, at Richard Dawkins. And you know who he is. He's the big atheist guy. He's a zoologist, if I'm not mistaken. So, you know, he does science. But he's also this sort of committed critic of theism, and he writes books and he gives lectures explaining why people who believe in God are essentially crazy. His book, The God Delusion, essentially says that. But anyway, he tweeted something that got him in trouble, and I think you're going to like this story. I like it. So he tweeted, in 2015, Rachel Dolezal, a white chapter president of the NAACP, was vilified for identifying as black. Some men chose to identify as women, and some women chose to identify as men. You will be vilified if you deny that they literally are what they identify as. Discuss. Now, first of all, what he said is true. You will be literally vilified. The Twitter mob will come for you. The stupid Twitter mob. Anyway, what he said is correct. And he's juxtaposing two issues here. In the case of Rachel Dolezal, you may remember, she was this white girl, both parents white, both sets of grandparents white. She grew up white. School pictures, she's white. And when she got into adulthood, she started, I guess, darkening her skin. And she changed her hair to look more African-American, I guess. And she passed herself off as black. And she was finally caught. And she had to step down from her position. She was working for the NAACP. And she was identifying as black. So the point that Richard Dawkins is making here, it's a good point. It's not a point that you haven't heard on this program any number of times. And the point is simply, if it's wrong to do that, if it's wrong to for a white person, let's say, to identify as black, even though she's not, then why isn't it wrong for a man to identify as a woman, even though he's not? He's not a woman. He may wear the wig and the makeup and the clothing, and he may even have an operation or two or three.
Come on, man.
But it doesn't make him a woman. He's still a man, chromosomally, etc. Then this is basic common sense 101. Children understand this, or at least they should understand it. So Richard Dawkins' point is, okay, so you can't do the one thing, but you can do the other thing. And the other thing is to change your sex or think that you can. And if you deny that somebody can do that, you will be vilified. That's his point. That's the whole thing. Well, guess what happened? The so-called American Humanist Association, who consider themselves free thinkers, don't you know? And they consider themselves, you know, the champions of logic over superstition, don't you know? They decided that they were going to, and they did, they revoked the Humanist of the Year award that they gave to Richard Dawkins. So he's one of their own. He's one of their heroes, or was anyway. Humanist of the Year awards are conferred annually by the American Humanist Association. This, according to the American Humanist Association's website, this is them speaking. It's like they don't even realize how ridiculous they look by doing this, but here's what they say. We confer this award annually, recognizing the awardee as an exemplar of humanist values. Communication of scientific concepts to the public is an important aspect of advancing the cause of humanism. Richard Dawkins was honored in 1996 by the AHA as Humanist of the Year for his significant contributions in this area. Regrettably, however, Richard Dawkins has, over the past several years, accumulated a history of making statements that use the guise of scientific discourse to demean marginalized groups, an approach antithetical to humanist values. Wait a minute, let's pause there. I thought that humanist values included extolling science as superior to your own personal beliefs. That's what you've heard, isn't it, Cyrus? I mean, you hear that on the street all the time, don't you?
Every day.
Constantly. So this is what is so strange about the American Humanist Association doing this, and that is they're changing the rules of the game. They're saying that when Richard Dawkins invokes, you know, science, that he's just doing the guise of scientific discourse by saying, you know, men are chromosomally, anatomically, etc. They're men. They're not women. They're really men. That's a scientific statement that can be verified by science and the scientific method. So now the American humanists, they're running wild because that's something up with which they cannot put, because it goes directly against their gender ideology. So they maintain this charade, saying his latest statement implies that the identities of transgender individuals are fraudulent. Well, okay, let's pause here for a second. Was Rachel Dolezal being fraudulent when, as a white woman, she was passing herself off as a black woman? Was that fraudulent or not? Yes or no? American Humanist Association, I'm talking to you. Yes or no? Was that fraudulent? They said yes. Okay. So if that's fraudulent, because she's not scientifically demonstrably black, she doesn't have skin pigmentation, excuse me. She doesn't have what other markers they might choose to use to identify whether or not somebody is a particular racial group or of a particular racial group. So is that fraudulent? They would say yes. So then how is it not fraudulent for the same kind of thing to be done, but it's just a different set of scientific markers? They don't explain that.
Hey, what happened?
You got to stay current here. Referring again to Richard Dawkins, they say his subsequent attempts at clarification are inadequate and convey neither sensitivity nor sincerity. This is brilliant. I love this. Consequently, the American Humanist Association Board has concluded that Richard Dawkins is no longer deserving of being honored by the AHA. Oh. And they have voted to withdraw, effective immediately, the 1996 Humanist of the Year Award. It's worthless. It's actually, I would say it's a resume enhancement for Richard Dawkins to have that reward withdrawn from him, because it is obviously not worth anything. Because the people who give it, they can't get their story straight. 888-914-9149. I love stories like that. Let's go to Ryan in Scottsdale. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, Patrick. I was hoping that you could help me with a question about conditional baptism.
All right. Let's see what I can do.
Yeah, so I have decided this is going to be the year that I come into the church, and I come from a Protestant background. And from the research that I've done, I understand that a baptism is valid if it's done in the proper form, the proper matter, and the proper intention.
Right.
Now, the proper matter, I'm 100% certain that it was the proper matter. I was baptized full immersion in water. The form, I think that it was done in the Trinitarian form. Mm-hmm. I'm not 100% certain that it was done correctly. And for the intention, that's where I have a lot of questions as well. I was from a non-denominational denomination, if that makes sense, where each individual church, they didn't have like a national headquarters or anything like that. Each individual church was allowed discretion in their activities based on their interpretation of the Bible.
Let me ask you a few questions. I think we could sort this out. So the church group that where you got baptized, and how old were you when you were baptized, Ryan?
I was young. I think I was 10 or 11, maybe 12 years old.
Okay. So when you were under the water, obviously you didn't hear the words that were spoken. Were your parents there? Were there any witnesses who could say, yes, he used the Trinitarian formula when he baptized you?
Yes. My parents were there. My dad actually is the one that performed the baptism.
Okay.
But I don't know. There's no like recording or anything like that.
Okay. So your dad is still alive, I presume, right? You can ask him, right?
Yes, I could definitely ask him. I don't know if his memory would be 100%.
Okay. Well, let's look at it this way. If you're certain that it was water, and you are, and you're certain that he, or you have reason to be certain that he used the Trinitarian formula, and it's as simple as asking him, Dad, what did you say when you baptized me? And if his memory serves and he says, well, I baptized you in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, okay, well, then you have a moral certitude that it was the correct form. Then the intention is really not an issue as long as your dad intending to do, at least in general, what the church does without understanding or even believing in baptismal regeneration. That would be a valid baptism, all other things being equal. So the intention does not seem to be problematic as long as that church was Trinitarian, one God in three persons. The church would recognize that as a valid baptism. Now, if you have any sufficient reason to doubt any part of that, and we've already sort of gone through and it looks as though you don't really have a reason to doubt it, but let's just say you can still be conditionally baptized. And that sounds like that was your question. If the church says that there's enough reason to think that maybe it might not have been valid, then you can be conditionally baptized when you are received into the church, which I think was your question.
Right? Yeah, and I guess I can be a little bit scrupulous at times. And I'd heard the story about Father Hood in the Detroit diocese where they got one word wrong, and it was not only a illicit, but an invalid baptism at that point.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And it happened once. This was just one of a couple of different ones where the priests later, they were watching video of their baptism, and to their horror, they realized that in one case, a deacon, I'll just leave it at that, he was freelancing and he was baptizing people left and right invalidly. So yeah, I'm familiar with that story. Very sad, but gladly, happily rather, it was rectified.
Right. So I was just wondering if it would be possible to get it a conditional baptism just in case, since I have, you know, certain issues with scrupulosity to begin with, and mm-hmm. the church that I belong to didn't quite take the process as seriously because it didn't really matter. There were people baptized in my church that didn't use the Trinitarian formula.
Yeah, so I think the answer is very simple. We've kind of already gone through it. If there's sufficient reason to think that there's any part of the sacrament that was invalid, then just get conditionally baptized. You can, and the priest will do that for you. That way, there's no guesswork. You're definitely baptized, either originally or in this case, you would be baptized through the conditional baptism. A word for those listening right now who may not understand this. You can only be validly baptized once. And this is why, once somebody is validly baptized, you can't be unbaptized, you can't be rebaptized, because it can only take place once, validly. Now, in the case of a conditional baptism, the priest would say, as he's pouring the water or immersing you, he would say, if you are not already baptized, I baptize you in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit. So it's not a rebaptism. And if you were validly baptized when you were 10 years old, then this doesn't do anything to you one way or the other. But if you weren't validly baptized, then it does. So just to make sure people don't think the Catholic Church has some form of rebaptism, we don't. I hope that's helpful, Ryan. Thank you. I have to take a break, but we'll be right back with more of your phone calls right here on the Patrick Madrid Show. I am live today. Had a little R&R last week, and boy, do I feel great. And I'm looking forward to talking to you. The number is 888-914-9149. I'll be right back.
Connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
I have something good for your Monday morning. It's the Chicago Cubs outfielder Rick Monday. You got to see this. I posted it on Twitter with two thumbs up. Today in 1976, Chicago Cubs outfielder Rick Monday saves the American flag from being burned at Dodger Stadium. That's great. Did you see this, Cyrus? It's fantastic.
It is awesome.
Yeah.
I love it.
I've watched it over. Okay, so here's what's happening. Some schmo is out in like center field or whatever, and he's got, you can't really tell what it is. It looks like it could be a shirt, but it's actually an American flag. And it's down on the ground, and looks like he's either trying to light it on fire, or maybe he's putting lighter fluid on it or something. Some other schmo runs over, and these two guys now are intent upon burning this American flag. And you hear the announcer making the call, and Rick Monday, he just comes out of nowhere. These guys don't see him because he's from behind them. He just runs by, swoops up the flag, and saves being burned. And the fans go crazy. They love it. You saw that part, right, Cyrus?
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, so there he goes. He grabs the flag, and the two guys are like, oh, come on, man. We were going to burn that flag.
Oh, come on.
He took our flag. It's great. I'm going to rewatch this.
Could
not
you
during
imagine
the show.
If that, so that was baseball, if that happened on an NFL field? some linebacker.
All that would be left would be cleat marks where that guy once stood. Yeah, this is good. And I'm glad his name is Rick Monday. I mean, I'm sure all the Cubs fans know who that is, but on a Monday morning, that suits me just fine. So check it out. You'll see it on my Twitter feed, at Patrick Madrid. It's going to give you, no, at Patrick Madrid. It'll give you a nice feeling. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Eric in Fresno. Good morning, Eric. Hello, Eric.
Hey, Patrick. How you doing?
I am well, thank you.
I called you about a year ago.
Okay.
I was coming to you distraught and sad because I had relapse on alcohol. And I just wanted to kind of give you an update that I've been sober from alcohol for about a year now.
Excellent.
And I just wanted to I just want to thank God and Relevant Radio and just about you know, everything that you do, and I want to thank Narcotics Anonymous too for you know, just the work that that allowed me to continue to stay sober.
What was it like for you? I remember, well, I think I remember when we spoke. So you had been sober for a while and you fell off the wagon, started drinking again.
Yeah.
And then what happened to get you back on the sober path again? And what's that been like for the last year, Eric?
Well, I mean, it's been an uphill battle, you know, battling, like, you know, addictions of like cigarettes and trying to break that addiction. And it's like you take one addiction out and then you kind of try and replace it with something else. So I had to replace all of that with, you know, with my faith and praying a lot more you know, finding healthier ways to cope. Mm-hmm. But it's definitely not been easy. But through a 12-step recovery program, it's definitely possible.
Yeah. Do you find now that a year into it, you're kind of past the cravings, or do they ever go away? I know for some people they never go away, but how are you dealing with it right now? Is it a white knuckle situation, or is it more calm right now?
Yeah, no, it's definitely calmer waters. There's not really, you know, the craving of addiction kind of, you know, it goes away after a while, but you know, in my recovery program, they talk about it in the literature and states that your addiction is sitting there in the corner. It's very, you know, sitting there in the corner doing push-ups, getting ready for you to mess up and waiting for you to pounce on you. Just like, you know, just like the devil is, you know, when you stay out of sin for a while, you get your strength back up. But then when you start to dip your toes back into sin, you slowly start to deteriorate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I'm so happy to hear that things are going well for you. And you go to meetings every so often, once a week, or how often do you go?
Yeah, I go regularly. I actually secretary a meeting as well. Another thing I wanted to tell you too is that, you know, my relationships with my family and with my girlfriend are definitely patched up and a lot more healthier. And I'm also I've also gotten the call for the vocation of marriage, and I'm gonna be marrying my girlfriend here pretty soon.
Wonderful.
Within the next year.
Congratulations. Yeah. Well, I'm happy for you. I'm happy for you, and I wish you all success. And God's grace will do it. Eric, I understand that you can't do it by yourself, but you're doing it. So that's awesome. Yeah. Thanks for sharing that with us.
Yeah, I'm trying. Thank you.
You're welcome.
You have a good day, Patrick. God bless.
Thank you, Eric. Well, it's a better day now that you and I have had a talk. Thank you, Eric. You know, Eric's story reminds me of a story that Jesus shared in Matthew chapter 12, beginning in verse 43, he says, "When the unclean spirit has gone out of a man, he passes through waterless places seeking rest, but he finds none. Then he says, 'I will return to my house from which I came.' But when he comes back, he finds it empty, swept, and put in order. Then he goes and brings with him seven other spirits more evil than himself, and they enter and dwell there. And the last state of that man becomes worse than the first. So shall it be also with this evil generation." Now, for the purposes of our discussion just a moment ago about sobriety, this is a cautionary tale, and it applies not merely to alcohol or any other form of an addiction. It can be anything, really. But put yourself in that situation. Jesus is describing you as somebody who has repented from whatever your sins may be, and you get back on track. And when the devil leaves, now, this is not to say that you are possessed or that you were possessed. We're not going that far with this analogy. But you can see that the influence of the devil is now gone from that person. And he comes back like, hey, you know, I'm back. And everything is clean now. It's swept and empty and put in order. So what does he do? This kind of goes back to something that Eric was saying about how your addiction is in the corner. I've never heard it put that way. It makes a lot of sense. Your addiction is in the corner doing push-ups, getting ready to mess with you if he has a chance to do so. So that's what this devil does, Jesus says. He goes and he gets more demons and he comes back and overpowers that man. So it's, in essence, it's backsliding back into sin. But the circumstances, Jesus says, are even worse now. And the person backslides even farther than he was before. So that's a good passage to think about when you find yourself in temptation. It's not worth it. Backsliding is just not worth it. That's Matthew chapter 12, beginning in verse 43. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Merrick now, listening in Albuquerque. Hi, Merrick.
Hi.
Yeah, hi.
I have one question.
Okay. What's your question, Merrick?
I've been wondering this week why women can't be priests.
Good question. Well, the simple reason is because Jesus is the one who established this sacrament, as he did all the other sacraments, and in it he chose only men to be ordained priests. Those would be the apostles. He didn't choose the Blessed Virgin Mary, his own mother, who is greater than any other human person, and he didn't choose her. He didn't choose any other women. And the church recognizes that it doesn't have the power or the authority to change something that Jesus himself established. So that's the short answer. There's a bit longer version of that in a document that was written by Pope John Paul II called Ordinatio Sacerdotalis. You don't have to worry about that Latin phrase. It just means on priestly ordination. And in it, Pope John Paul II, he explains that reason. He also gives several other reasons as to why the church can't change this teaching given by Jesus. But that's it in a nutshell. Mm. Now, there's more. But you know what? Since we have time, I'll give you a little bit more. Another reason is that the priest, for example, celebrating Mass, is, as the Latin phrase goes, in persona Christi, which means in the person of Christ. Doesn't mean that he is Jesus. It means that he's fulfilling this role of Jesus as the high priest celebrating Mass. Now, this is one example. But Merrick, you probably have read in the New Testament about how the church is the bride of Christ, right? You've heard that before?
Yeah, I've heard that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And that Jesus is the groom. In other words, the husband. And the church is the wife, right? So one of the problems is that if there were a woman who was celebrating Mass, and in the words of the bridegroom, the husband, she's speaking the words of married love to the bride, to the church, you've got a distortion in meaning there, insofar as you would have a woman speaking the words of the husband to another woman. Now, that in itself is not a major reason why the church says that women can't be priests, but it is a reason that flows from the fact that Jesus was a man. He was revealed as the second person of the Trinity as a man. He could have become something androgynous, I guess. He could have been something neither man nor woman. But the fact that from all eternity, God the Son chose to be incarnate and live with us, among us, as a man, says something specific about his mission. God is not man or woman. God is not male or female, so we don't argue that point. But the fact that Jesus was revealed to us as a man when he could have been presumably something else, that too has a role to play in the church's response to your question. So how's that? Does that get you where you need to be? I know we're short on time, but does that help a little bit?
Yeah, helps a lot, actually.
Okay. Do you use Twitter, Merrick?
Unknown.
All right. Well, if you can get online, I don't know how old you are, but if it's okay with your parents, go to relevantradio.com/Patrick. And in a couple of minutes, you're going to see a link to this article by Pope John Paul II. Called Ordinatio Sacerdotalis. You'll see it in the Twitter section. We're going to get that posted for you so you can read it for yourself, and you'll see exactly what the Pope said on this topic. I think that'll help you, Merrick, okay?
Yeah, it'll help me.
Good. How old are you?
I'm 10 years old.
Cool. So if you're 10 years old, I'm guessing that means you're probably in fifth grade?
Yeah, I'm in fifth grade.
How is it to be in the fifth grade? I'm trying to remember.
It's good. It's also scary because I'm going to be in no more in elementary school.
Oh, you're going to go to middle school next, right?
Yeah, it's kind of scary for me.
You'll like it. Seventh grade. You'll like it. You'll have fun in middle school. All your friends will be there. And then you'll be in high school. And then, you know, a couple blinks of the eye and you'll be an old man like me. It just goes by real fast. I'm just joking, Merrick. It doesn't go by that fast. But enjoy your childhood. Enjoy it. Thank God for it. And really get as much out of your childhood as you possibly can, because it does go by quickly. I can guarantee you that. Thanks, Merrick. I appreciate it. Tell your mom and dad thank you for letting you call me. Well, hour one of the program is over. Cyrus, I can't even believe that. It's like it just started and now it's done. But we have hour two and then hour three right in front of us. And we'll get to that right after this. Please stay right there. I'll be right back.